Since 2006 on the radio, and I've been looking for the best guests I can find telling the most interesting things that you're never going to hear in the corporate-controlled mainstream. And I would add the most important things as well, because there is a difference. Anyway, today we have a brand new Truth Jihad radio guest coming on to talk about a topic that's very timely for me. The topic is the issue of why high IQ idiots, and I think Noam Chomsky would probably qualify for that description, are unable to grasp such very simple and obvious issues as that the 9/11 official story is not just blatantly, obviously untrue, demonstrably untrue in every single one of its many, many ludicrous aspects, but just completely preposterous. And I've seen this approach from many angles. We've discussed psychology of 9/11, truth denial, and things like that on this show many, many times. I've worked a bit with Fran Schur, who's publishing a book on the psychology of 9/11 truth denial with architects and engineers. But I think Jonathan Roeske, in a couple of pieces he's written, has nailed a couple of things that you don't really need a psychologist to explain to you about why there's this kind of well of denial. And people from like Chomsky are drinking the Kool-Aid from that well. And I'm going to have to talk about this at the Left Forum, which is coming up in New York City on May 20th to 22nd. So without further ado, let me get some help for my presentation from Jonathan Roeske. How are you, Jonathan?
Oh, I'm doing fine. You know, thanks for having me on. I'm a big fan of yours. I've been following your work for, I don't know how long exactly. Maybe not since 2006, but maybe half of that period. As I said to you in email, I figure we agree on things at the 80 to 90% level.
I'd say maybe 95 even. No, let's put metaphysics aside. That's too complicated to expect agreement on anyway. Let's get right into this issue of the Roger Rabbit world of high IQ idiots. I really like that piece. It looks like you got a big reaction from it.
Yeah. Ron Unz told me that it was one of the most popular things he'd ever run. Actually, I don't have access to all the various traffic statistics that he would, I suppose. But, I got a fair bit of private feedback on it.
And the title is Battling the Matrix and Freeing Oneself from the Roger Rabbit Mental World. And of course, a lot of people have understood this red pill metaphor from the Matrix film in a different way after they woke up to something like 9/11 truth. And so you start there, then you go on with a Roger Rabbit movie metaphor, which is a little bit less well known.
Well, the movie Who Framed Roger Rabbit, I was actually surprised at how old the movie it is. It's I think 28, 29 years old. I thought it was more recent, then Googled it and discovered that it's, nearly 30 years old. The director is Roger Zemeckis, I believe. He's the same guy who did what's that movie with the idiot Tom Hanks? Forrest Gump.
Forrest Gump, yeah. Oh, yeah, right. You know, I've talked about the Forrest Gump effect, actually. With regard to the witnesses who imagine that they saw Barbara Olson waving out the window of the 757 airplane as it flew into the Pentagon and things like that. People automatically project themselves in the middle of big historic events. And so the planners of 9/11 could have known ahead of time that very, very large numbers of people would claim to have seen things like plane crashes into buildings and so on and so forth in accordance with the official story.
One correspondent told me that, he was just in awe of 9/11 because the understanding of human psychology necessary to execute something like that was just awe-inspiring. You know, you couldn't. He thought it was on a different level from you know, the Kennedy assassination or any other deep event. But anyway, you asked me about Roger Rabbit. Roger Rabbit is this movie in which cartoons and real actors share the screen rather seamlessly. I mean, actually, Video Fakery, the director, you know, I mean, he put Tom Hanks in these historical scenes in the other movie, so he's very sort of interested in inserting people or cartoons and playing with video like that. Mm-hmm. But the mental world of the hickey, I guess, the high IQ idiot, is something of a Roger Rabbit mental universe. I thought it was a good analogy and started playing with it in my mind, and that was something I brought in that essay. You know, I think it dawned on me one day that Osama bin Laden is a cartoon character.
Absolutely.
He's this Saudi multimillionaire or billionaire or whatever who lives in a cave in Afghanistan, and a religious fanatic, allegedly, who directs these lethal terrorist events from his cave in Afghanistan. I mean, he is he's like a villain from a James Bond film.
Well, yeah, or you know, when George W. Bush said, "We're going to smoke him out. We're going to smoke him out of his cave." You know, he was playing Elmer Fudd, and Bin Laden was Bugs Bunny.
yeah, Roger Rabbit, but which is Bugs Bunny more or less.
Yeah.
But of course Bugs Bunny is 100% cartoon, whereas Roger Rabbit, real people and the cartoon share the screen. You see, so it's a bit of a more subtle thing. It's not to say that everything they present you is a cartoon,
mm-hmm.
because that's actually not the case. I mean, some of the things they present you are actually real people, but then they're cartoons. You know, it's
mm-hmm.
So it's more subtle than that. But I would say that if you look at the various you know, James Bond movies and all the villains, actually, I don't think very many of them are quite as compelling as Bin Laden. I mean, there's Dr. No, who is sort of a Fu Manchu redux. Then you have Goldfinger. Goldfinger is a funny one because, of course, Goldfinger is an anti-Semitic stereotype, this rich Jew Goldfinger loves gold so much that he paints his women gold so that he can be making love to gold. I mean, you know, he I mean, that's
you think Ian Fleming was like thinking of Rothschild or something?
No, actually, I looked up the story once, and it's a very, very funny story, actually. Goldfinger was a real person and was a Jew. And you see, what happened is that when Ian Fleming wrote his first big hit novel, bestseller, I wouldn't know which one it was, he took the proceeds and he bought a village house in a very picturesque, historical English village, very picturesque place, I forget where. And then this rich, and he was Jewish, this rich Jew, Goldfinger, showed up and bought, you know, two or three village houses, and he raised them and built on that land some modern monstrosity that completely destroyed the aesthetics of the village in which Ian Fleming had bought a house. And that, you know, that pissed off old Ian Fleming so much that he named the villain in his next novel Goldfinger.
So this guy's actual name was Goldfinger?
Yeah, it's a real name, and you
really?
Know, almost anybody whose name is Goldfinger is in fact Jewish.
I've heard of Goldstein. I've heard of Emmanuel Goldstein and other Goldsteins. I hadn't heard of actual Goldfingers.
No, this was a real guy. He bought a, you know, at least two, maybe three houses next to one another in this historical village, and I guess they weren't, you know, cataloged so that he couldn't just raise them and build something, you know, god-awful in their place. You know, he should have been historically protected, I guess. So he shows up, and he just destroys the aesthetics of this village, and Ian Fleming got his revenge by making this guy the villain in his next novel. And what's funny, of course, about it is, you know, all of this stuff, you know, painting women gold so he can be making love to gold, you know, is such a classic. You know, and I say it as somebody of Jewish ancestry, part Jewish ancestry, you know, it's such a classic anti-Semitic stereotype.
Yeah, it sounds like some kind of anti-Semitic folk legend or something.
Well, I mean, it's a joke, really.
Joke, a Jewish joke.
You know, he's just taking the whole idea so far. And then, but of course, when they made the movie, I guess they went and asked Ian Fleming about this character Goldfinger. Oh, no, he's not Jewish. No. you know, he's, I think he was some kind of, I think he was supposed to be from the Baltic states or something. So he was from Lithuania or Latvia or Estonia. I don't know where I don't know. They invented a whole different thing from him. He was an ex-Nazi. He wasn't.
There you go.
Or a Nazi collaborator. Like somehow he got.
You know, the Nazis are kind of cartoon villains too, as far as that goes.
Well, yeah.
I mean, it doesn't mean there's reality. Just there's a real Bin Laden, and then there are cartoon. Distortions of Bin Laden. Same with
Nazis. That's the exact idea. There was a real historical Bin Laden. I mean, there was this real guy. And, you know, I don't know what is known about him. I mean, there's the real historical person, and then there's the Roger Rabbit. You know, they've superimposed a cartoon over him, it would seem. You know, I mean, because, you know, this – and then they said he was responsible for all of these different terrorist events. And who knows what he was, certainly not 9/11, but I mean, supposedly he was responsible for, I don't know, something that had, I don't know. There's a whole list of things that he was supposedly responsible for.
Right. But all of those things, are, well, at least all of his attacks on the U.S. are, disputed by, alternative researchers who would argue that, at the most, you know, he may have sort of been loosely affiliated with some of the people involved in, like, the African embassy bombings, the USS Cole bombing. But in fact, those bombings appear to have been false flags. We do know that the logistics guy behind the African embassy bombings was none other than Sergeant Ali Mohammed, who was a CIA and U.S. Army Special Forces agent. And the official story, of course, is that he was a, you know, double agent who was really working for the cartoon villain Bin Laden. But it looks more likely that the whole thing was a setup to erect Bin Laden and Al-Qaeda to the status of plausible patsy for 9/11.
Well, you know, what occurs to me about all of this is you have all of these villains and their henchmen being presented, and they seem to have, you know, very cartoonish elements to them. I mean, like, you have the final scene, and I mentioned this in the article, though they denied it later, that Bin Laden had, you know, grabbed a woman, like one of his wives, to use as a, quote, a human shield, unquote.
Isn't that ridiculous? When the story first hit, it was so absurd that I was able to crank out a piece ridiculing it in about, you know, 15 minutes that went mega viral. You know, there was that grabs his wife as human shield thing. There was this, and then we threw his body in the ocean according to Islamic burial custom, which is so bizarre. I mean, Islamic burial custom is to, you know, wrap the body in a white sheet and bury it inland immediately. There's no such thing as throw it in the ocean. I mean, so there were so many of these bizarre cartoonish elements.
Apparently you can chuck somebody in the ocean if you're in a long sea voyage.
Well, yeah, of course.
And there's no alternative because the dead body will spread disease. You know, then you can chuck them in the ocean.
Right. But Bin Laden didn't die on a long sea voyage, according to
the
story.
But by the same token, I suppose, if you were on a desert island and the only thing, you know, you could eat was some tinned pork or something.
Exactly.
Your alternative, your alternative was to starve.
Very good. Are you a Sharia scholar?
No, I just, that just occurs to me.
No, it's common sense, but that is actually very much part of Islamic law, that necessity, you know, allows you to do those things. And indeed, it, if you were in outer space, you could probably legitimately throw a body into outer space. But in this case, the idea that the U.S. military would take the body out to sea and throw it in the ocean, according to Islamic custom, is just this. It's like they just made it up.
Well, they did make it up.
Like the human shield thing.
But the wife that he supposedly denied it later, but the wife that he supposedly used as a human shield, and he had, how many wives did he supposedly have there? I don't know, at least two, right? Because it's plural. But
three, maybe.
You know, well, I don't know. They were repatriated to Saudi Arabia after that, right? And you think one of the damnedest things about all of this is, wouldn't that be like the human interest scoop of a decade? Go just talk to these women.
You would think, wouldn't you? And how about the human interest scoop of talking to the relatives of the alleged hijackers? Although of the few that have been contacted, they all scoff at the official story and are volunteering to give DNA to show that their loved ones had nothing to do with this, and so on and so forth. I mean, how about the 19 hijackers? Let's talk to that rich Saudi diplomat who had two sons supposedly involved in 9/11. Only one of them showed up alive at the U.S. Embassy in Rabat, Morocco, after 9/11, saying that, yeah, that's my picture, that's my brother, but no, I didn't do that. I wasn't on that. Here I am. So yeah, let's go talk to those people's relatives in Saudi Arabia. You know, this whole business of the mysterious 28 pages being finally revealed about the Saudi connection to 9/11 is kind of interesting, because I think the Saudis have obviously been playing along with the official version. And if they get really pissed off, they could blow it right out of the water by producing some of these people and explaining that the 15 Saudis were intelligence assets, things like that.
Well, we always think, yeah, there's so-and-so has got information and they're going to blow it out of the water. And so, but I wouldn't get my hopes up about it, because it just doesn't seem to matter, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, we know that what they claim happened is physically impossible, and it just doesn't seem to matter. So, you know, it's so getting your hopes up that the Saudis will produce whatever information. You know, it's but you know, I mean, there'll be a human interest scoop. You go to Saudi Arabia and talk to Bin Laden's. You know, you just imagine some trashy American periodical. They could send somebody to interview these women, ask them how Osama was in bed, and you know, I mean, just get all salacious.
Yeah,
you know?
of course, and yeah, there's so many other examples of the same thing. For example, how about that U.S. serviceman who allegedly discovered the Fatty Bin Laden confession video? I think it was that in it was Kandahar. Was it in Afghanistan? There was that video that turned up in December of 2001 with a fat guy who looks a little bit like Bin Laden, at least in some of the frames, sort of chortling about 9/11 and, you know, saying that, oh, you know, we knew that the top part would collapse, but we didn't know the whole thing would collapse, you know, due to my engineering experience, blah, blah, blah. And it's taken as a confession video. And yet, where's the guy who found it? It's supposedly discovered by a U.S. serviceman by mistake, by accident. Here's the human interest story of the century. Here's an American national hero. And there's no name. There's no chain of custody for that video. And of course, the reason is it's blatantly a fraud. It's another cartoon.
Yeah, it's, But you see, none of these things seem to matter, you know. I mean, if you, there's a certain kind of, you started asking me about these high IQ idiots who I call, you know, I guess the pronunciation would be hickey, you know.
Yeah, hickey sounds good. It's better than hickey. That doesn't work. It's you better call it hickey.
Yeah, I guess you know, people can pronounce whatever they want, but I mean, I haven't had the opportunity to pronounce the term that much. I've just corresponded to people about it, so I always assumed the I say jokingly in my next essay, which should appear in the next couple of days when they put it up, you know, that the BDQ, you know, if you're British and you want us to think that's the Bullock's detection quotient, you know, I mean, you know, it's that's okay too, you know. But you know, I said in the first essay that BDQ stood for bullshit detection quotient, you know, but you know, we can be open on these things, but anyway, you asked me about the psychology of the hickey, you know, and the psychology of, you know, there's a real there's kind of that desperate need to delude oneself that is somehow inculcated in people. You see, one thing that dawned on me about all of this is people's willingness to believe bullshit has almost nothing to do with how plausible the bullshit is. It has to do with their desperate need to believe it, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, if you are married to somebody who's an unfaithful spouse, and there are all of these dead giveaways that the person is, you know, having an affair, or, you know, I mean, if you have a desperate need to believe that the person, you know, is faithful, then you could just over, you know, I mean, the person gives you whatever far-fetched story about their whereabouts, you know, last night, you know, and you'll believe it because you have a desperate need, you know, psychologically to believe it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And then, of course, that's a common situation, and it's the fodder of popular culture, and people do sort of understand that. But with these deep events or state crimes against democracy, like 9/11, the JFK assassination, you know, false flag events, in those instances, it seems that even though these are events that are in the public domain, they're public realm, they're not really personally.
I can't hear you. Hello?
I'm sorry. Can you hear me now?
We're cut off.
Huh, that's very strange, because I'm still here.
Could you hear me when I said I can't hear you? I can hear you now.
Yeah, I can hear you the whole time. I'm hearing.
Oh, okay.
So I don't know what happened.
No,
I. But anyway, okay, so we're talking about how these like the unfaithful spouse scenario is a kind of a common part of people's experience, not necessarily their own, but somebody they know, or it's also very, very big in popular culture. People know that there are these kinds of lies. People. In ordinary life, as well as in popular culture, discussions of ordinary life encounter this situation of cheating spouses, and they know about that type of deception, and they can see other people deceiving themselves. It's all pretty much known and accepted. But with these deep events, like 9/11, JFK, false flags, and so on, these are events that do not touch most of us directly. They're part of our shared sort of imaginary social world, or our imagination of history and what's going on, you know, somewhere outside of my house, you know. And for some reason, though, people do seem to be far more unable to understand these kinds of deceptions, even when it's really obvious who profits from them and how they could be orchestrated, than the other kinds of deceptions in ordinary life. Sort of reminds us maybe of Hitler and the big lie concept, that if the lie is big enough, people will just believe it.
Well, yeah, but for starters, in a sense, what's the big deal about the Kennedy assassination, right? I mean, if you say these people assassinated, you know, another political figure, you know, that they assassinated, they assassinated the president of Panama, you know, Omar Torrijos, I think was the guy's name, when a plane crash, right?
Yep. Yeah, John Burton's talked about that.
Right, that's just one example. That's the one that came to my mind. You know, they kept trying to assassinate Fidel Castro, you know, but never managed to somehow. And that's well documented. And then there are a whole bunch of other cases. So a lot of these people would accept that the CIA, you know, had the, you know, engaged in assassinations and even assassinated the head of state of another country. Yet somehow you're crazy if you believe that they assassinated Kennedy, who was the president of the United States. Now, operationally, there's no difference between killing Kennedy and killing Torrijos or killing you or me. I mean, it's not too hard to kill somebody.
Well, it's actually easier to kill your own president than to kill somebody else's president because you're the Praetorian Guard of your own president. False flags are easier than attacks on other countries. It's easier to do a big false flag or an assassination of a high-level figure such as a president, like right here in the United States, than to go do it somewhere else. Because if you have to go after Saddam Hussein, he's got doubles and bodyguards who really protect him. Fidel Castro had fanatically loyal bodyguards. They couldn't get him. But it was easy to get Kennedy because they were Kennedy's bodyguards.
Yeah, that's true. But somehow there's a kind of, it's strange because, you know, you can't get anybody to understand a false flag. Now, they couldn't be lying to us about that. It's like, they'll accept, on the other hand, that they were running this illegal kidnapping and torture campaign, for example, you know, torturing people in black sites like Guantanamo and elsewhere. So you believe that somebody would kidnap and torture people, but they wouldn't lie to you. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's like saying that. I mean, I was thinking an example, getting back to the cheating spouse. You have some woman in the story saying, well, it becomes clear that her husband is a serial killer and was, you know, murdering people and eating them and stuff. And then it also is true. It turns out that he was, you know, having an affair. And the woman says, Well, I can accept that he was, you know, murdering all these people, but my Henry would never cheat on me, you know? I mean, yeah. you know what I mean? It's like, well, they would torture people and they would start a war and they would, you know, they would drop atomic bombs on a couple of cities, but they wouldn't lie to me about 9/11, you know? I mean, you know, they wouldn't lie to me about this, that, or the other thing. Mm-hmm. And there's something quite delusional about that, isn't
Absolutely.
There?
It goes right to the heart of this issue with Chomsky that I'll be raising in my presentation at the Left Forum in a little over a week, which is that, you know, what Chomsky is saying, it kind of cuts in two ways. On the one hand, he's reinforcing this ludicrous delusion that, oh, they wouldn't do that. That would be too awful. And then on the other hand, he's saying, well, it doesn't really matter if they did it because they've done all these much, much worse things anyway. And the reason it does matter is that if you want social change, which Chomsky presumably does, you need to inform the people with the power to get some change, which is, to a certain extent, the people of the United States, who could end their empire if they got angry enough at the military-industrial complex and the masters of empire. How are you going to get them angry? How are you going to help them see that they have a stake in this fight? Well, if you show them that these masters of empire will mass murder them just as easily as they'll mass murder people in other countries, that's how you're going to get the American people to rise up and shut down their empire. That's how you're going to motivate them, is by showing this thing that they see as being so awful, such a betrayal. Well, yeah, they'll do that. So if you want to get the people who can actually change things on the side of change, you have to show them 9/11 truth. If you just show them, murdered a million Iraqis, that's unfortunately not going to do it. And now Chomsky's response to that argument in our email dialogue,
which
went very sour, was, you terrible man, you're saying such terrible things about the American people. Of course they would be very, very angry about a million Iraqis. Whatever. But well, yeah, how can somebody like him not get this?
Well, the famous Upton Sinclair quote, when a man's job... when a man's job depends on him not understanding something, though you seem to be assuming that Chomsky is sincere, which
I'm going to start with that because of my audience, the Left Forum, but yeah, continue.
But the whole notion of you expressed that you like the articles that I wrote, so, you know, the second one hasn't appeared yet, but maybe there by the time this interview appears. But the one thing that I don't do in these articles I wrote is I don't take a very conventional approach to the question. I mean, I take a rather different approach. You see, and that's one thing that I've considered. I mean, all of this sort of earnest moralizing doesn't seem to work. I mean, suppose you know tomorrow, you know they incinerate some isolated village somewhere in the Hindu Kush, and you know when some talking head general gets on CNN and said, "Oh yes, we were defending America. We had to destroy that village there because there were enemies of America, and we were defending America." And you would think that, and you know, this goes back because you know they bombed all these villages in Southeast Asia, and they were supposedly, I guess they were supposedly defending America. They had the domino theory, or they had some kind of theory that why they were destroying these villages, right? But. The anti-war approach of trying to get the American public or the Western public to, or most of them, to identify with the victims of this savagery as fellow human beings, you can say that approach should work, but it doesn't. Somebody like Donald Trump or any of the Republicans will get up there and rant about how they're willing to carpet bomb ISIS, which, you know, means carpet bombing civilians, and I'd carpet bomb and I'd torture, you know, I'm bring back all that waterboarding. I mean, there's a huge segment of the population that gets emotional satisfaction, actually, out of this kind of savagery. I mean, that's very real. So simple. And in fact, it is not a vote winner for any of these people running for president to start saying, well, look at all these, you know, because because it's just cast as them being soft on the terrorists or something. So my approach in these essays is not to go that direction. You know, one could. And it's not that I don't think that that's valid. I of course I do. But the problem is, if it doesn't work, it doesn't work, right? You understand my point. I mean, the approach I am taking is to say, well, this is a psychotic rupture with reality. These are comic books, right? Mm-hmm. These are comic book characters. You know, the whole idea that you they destroy some village in the third world because these people are somehow a threat to us. I mean, this is a real psychotic rupture with reality. I mean, I remember my first trip, rather adventurous trip to a third world country. It was, I think, in 1987. I went with a friend on a motorcycle through Mexico. And I remember I was, we went to, for some reason we were in some village, and it was, you know, one of these villages where the pigs were part of the ecology of the village. They had these, you know, like pigs running through the streets and
four-legged garbage recyclers.
Exactly, yes. And I remember I had to make a phone call for some reason. And there was a larger town like 4 miles away. You could go down on a dirt road, and they had, you know, like the Spanish word is locutorio. What's that in English? A place where you make a phone call. I mean, I don't even know what the word in English for that is, because everybody's got a phone, right? What's a locutorio in English? You know, it's a
no
calling.
Existe, señor. No existe.
Right. But, you know, it's a business where you go and make a phone call, right? I suppose 100 years ago there were locutorios everywhere in North America, because only a rich person owned had a telephone in their house, yeah, right?
Likewise, there are teleboutiques still in Morocco, and I don't recall seeing a whole lot of teleboutiques here in the United States. Originally, they were for telephones, and then they became for internet.
Well, it wouldn't be it wouldn't be a great business idea in North America, in a first world country, and even in current day, though they still exist throughout in Latin America. I noticed in my last trip, you know, these places where people go to make a phone call. You know, I mean, so anyway, I went to the, but I walked 4 or 5 miles to, or maybe I forget the distance, to make a phone call, right? And they did have some electricity via a generator, you know, but, you know, they had no phone. Most people didn't have any electricity. Yeah, I mean, it was a village in Mexico in the 80s. Mexico's come a long way since then, actually. I was there. But at any rate, if you were there in this village with the pigs running through the streets, no electricity, and somebody said to you, you know, these people are enemies of America, and we must incinerate this village, you would think that this person is criminally insane, right? I mean, how can, you know, even if these people wanted to attack America, how would they ever do it, you know? I mean, a couple of years ago, I was hiking around a mountain village, you know, in the Atlas Mountains in Morocco, you know? And you just think to yourself, well, if these people really ever thought, not that they're thinking about it. I mean, it's like if you asked any of these people, you know, you want to attack America? What are you talking about? Where's that? I mean, the whole idea that people in some isolated third world village are thinking constantly about how they're going to somehow attack America is a complete psychotic rupture with reality, right?
Absolutely. You know, that's a part of your essay that I did want to respond to, because as you point out, the so-called blowback theory of terrorism, that, you know, 9/11 was blowback for our terrible treatment of the Islamic world. This is Chomsky's line par excellence, and so on. This, as you say, is ludicrous, that these, you know, empires throughout history, British Empire and so on, have not had people from their oppressed imperial provinces coming to the center of the empire, to London or to New York and Washington, and blowing things up. And there's a good reason for that, not only that the people out there in the exploited provinces of the empire don't want
it. It doesn't occur to them.
Well, most of them, it doesn't occur to them. But there are people who fight back against empire. But guess what? They don't come to the imperial heartland to do attacks. Why not? Because it doesn't work. The book by Robert Pape, which is what it's called, was it Dying to Win? It's the total, he looked at every single act of suicide terrorism on the record when he wrote the book. And he discovered that they all had, yeah, they were all exactly the same. In every single case, it was people fighting to expel imperial invaders and occupiers from their country, in their country. They don't ever go to the imperial country to blow things up. Why not? Because it wouldn't work. If a Vietnamese peasant thought that somehow getting to the U.S. and blowing up the World Trade Center would convince Nixon to pull out of Vietnam, he would be out of his mind, because that would give Nixon the excuse to nuke Vietnam. Likewise with the anti-imperialist Muslims, of whom I am one, thank you. I'm not stupid enough to think that randomly massacring civilians in the United States is going to get the U.S. out of the Islamic world. Quite the opposite. However, I strongly support Hamas, Hezbollah, Islamic Jihad, and various other groups that are fighting to liberate their territories rationally. Now, it is, you can say, as Chomsky would say, well, that's very sad that people die in these other territories. Americans should die, too. Well, Chomsky, if you think they should, go out and kill some Americans. That's okay with me if you really have to do that. But I don't think number one, it's not morally justifiable to kill innocent people, I mean, no matter how stupid they are. And number two, it's counterproductive, and so you're just going to cause more mayhem in the occupied countries.
But the thing is that it's just simply not psychologically plausible. Let's just imagine that the People's Liberation Army of China was occupying Wisconsin. And they, you know, behaving terribly, just being real oppressors. Would it occur to you or to anybody you know to try to make your way to China, to some town there, like the Chinese equivalent of San Bernardino, shall we say,
or just kill a white school?
Well, that's an incredible one, right? But I get to, you know, we can talk about that. But would it occur to you to go to the China, just some town in China, like the equivalent of San Bernardino? I mean, someplace nobody ever heard of, you know? You know, that nobody cares about, and just kill some
random... attack a facility for disabled people. You can't make this stuff up.
It would never occur to I mean, it would occur to you. Maybe it would occur to you to do a suicide bombing of the nearest Chinese military base. Yes,
sure, or make some IEDs for the Chinese tanks. Sure, I would do that.
Or, if you were on the coast and there was a Chinese warship docked to attack the Chinese, to blow up the Chinese warship, but to actually just try to make, it wouldn't occur to most people because most people understand that the ordinary Chinese person has no say in what the the government's doing anyway. They would just never, it would just not occur to them to do that, right? I mean, it wouldn't, the people who disliked the British Empire, it really just wouldn't occur to them to go to London and just, you know, kill some shopkeepers or some, you know, I mean, it just doesn't occur to people.
So how do you think they created this motif of this kind of, you know, terrorism in our homeland?
Well, there may be a few cases. Well, there's the IRA, I guess. You see, I'm thinking about what there is.
Yeah.
But the IRA is still Ireland, which is the British Isles. So you could say they're one of the, you know, and even then, I don't know how much of that is false flag.
Yeah, a lot of it's false flag. The worst atrocities the IRA committed were committed by the British infiltrators. They were the worst murderers. You know, they earned their bona fides by killing people because the innocent, real IRA guys didn't imagine that the British infiltrators would be allowed to run around killing people. So, okay, you have to go kill this guy, and if you kill him, that means that you're authentic. Well, then the British agent goes and, like, you know, kills the guy and his family and 30 other people. And then, wow, you must be really authentic.
I don't know the story on that.
Yeah, there's
you
an
know?
Article in the, I think it was the Atlantic, one of these mainstream American magazines about, what, eight years ago, I think, that uncovered the fact that the worst atrocities, the nastiest killers in the IRA were the British agents.
That doesn't surprise me, but I wasn't aware of that. But there's just so much of this stuff, it's hard to know all of it, you know.
Tell me about it.
you know, like if you want to send me a link to that at some point, you know. I mean, you know, there's all these things, but I mean if the British occupied India for you know, however long, you know, at least 100 years, I don't know, how long were the British running India, you know, and never in all of that time did a single person from India even try to, you know, make their way to London and blow something up, it kind of does indicate that blowback terrorism isn't that big a problem, really. You know, I mean, it just doesn't. Yeah, but as I said, the blowback.
Wait, can I give you a theory then of why this has been manufactured? Quick. I mean, obviously there are many beneficiaries, but one of the key beneficiaries, I would argue, is the beneficiary that dare not speak its name, as Zelikow would say, which is the state of Israel, which faces a very real problem of quote-unquote terrorism, that is armed resistance from the people it's genociding. And in order to convince the West and the world that this radical Islamic terrorism is not just Israel's problem, because that's a hard sell, and the Europeans don't care much about that, I tell you frankly, says Philip Zelikow, we therefore have to bring this anti-Israel terrorism to the West, and that's why the dancing Israelis, arrested on 9/11, said, we're not your problem. The Palestinians are our problem and your problem. And that has been the propaganda line with every one of these attacks. Every time it happens, you know, Netanyahu is up there strutting around saying, see, we told you. We told you that those evil anti-Israel terrorists were going to hit you too. And of course, it's because it's Netanyahu who's doing most of that terrorism.
I think that's true. Yeah. I mean, if you looked at any of these events where Arabs or Muslims, you know, are getting framed for them, if you simply assumed that the Zionists were behind it, I think you'd pretty much never be wrong. I mean,
that was my first thought on 9/11, actually, from, you know, I was in an Arabic program, and so I knew a little bit about the backdrop. And, my first thought was, it's probably the Israelis behind this. And then in 2004, when David Ray Griffin, his work, were actually late 2003.
Yeah, he never goes there as far
No,
as
he
I
never
know.
Goes there. And so I kind of followed David Ray for several years, kind of, you know, tiptoeing gingerly around that and instead pointing to the top of the U.S. chain of command, which was complicit, of course. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, the major beneficiary here and the party with the means, motive, and opportunity and so much to lose that it was worth risking it ultimately was this hardline Likudnik faction in Israel.
Well, the thing is that once you look at once you realize that Osama bin Laden, Al Qaeda is just are just patsies and they didn't do it, then your short list of the people with the means and the motive is pretty short. I mean, that's the problem. The problem is that the people, you don't just have to be able operationally to blow up the building, say, but what you have to be able to do is fashion the narrative from day one, right? You need a significant amount of control over the mainstream media, not just in the United States, but in the Western world as a whole. You know, because the very same day, you know, hardly anybody had ever heard of Osama bin Laden, and the very same day, practically, they're talking about it as an absolute certainty that this guy Osama bin Laden was behind it. You know, and they never presented any proof. Mm-hmm. So who has the control over the media to even these recent things like that Charlie Hebdo thing? I mean that's fascinating. I know you have, and I haven't read it. Your book that you in collaboration with various other authors.
We are not Charlie Hebdo. It's actually being translated into French. And by the time people hear this show, it should be available to purchase on Amazon in French.
Yeah, I had correspondence with a French guy who I met traveling, and I had a rupture with him because I told him that within a few. It's funny; it took me about 5 minutes to realize it was a false flag. Maybe 10 minutes, but
you're faster than me. It took me at least 15.
I'm figuring if it took me 10 years to realize that 9/11 was a false flag, and it took me 10 minutes to realize that Charlie Hebdo was a false flag, that means that I'm improving. You know, my BDQ is rising. You know, getting a little bit faster. You know, but that's a very funny thing because, you know, you have this story in which these fanatical Muslims, they show up in the middle of Paris with, you know, AK-47s and grenade launchers because they're so mad at some cartoonists, right?
And I actually thought that was plausible for 15 minutes.
But then you realize that does something like that really happen in the real world? I mean, it's very cartoonish, you know. It's you see, what finally gets me about it is they were selling this Charlie Hebdo rag, right, all across France in kiosks, and openly, as far as I can tell. And was there ever an incident where some angry Muslim just grabbed a stack of the magazines and just tore them up or threw them in the river? To express their disgust with it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I believe that if something like that had happened, or certainly if it would commonly happened, we would know about it. They would have said something about it. But there, you know, so you're asked to believe that people never even just grabbed a bunch of the magazines and chucked them in the nearest dumpster, and then they go from doing nothing to showing up in the middle of Paris with with military weaponry. You know, there's something, you know, so unbelievable about that. Violence doesn't work like that normally, does it? I mean, normally, you know, that's the old expression, when push comes to shove, right? Somebody gets angry and slaps somebody, and then somebody else, you know, punches or kicks them, you know, and then somebody pulls a knife or a gun, and, you know, somebody really gets hurt. But, you know, you get an escalation of violence, right? Yeah. Here you have going from zero, you know, you don't go from like 0 to 60 in 6 seconds. You go from 0 to 60, you know, instantaneously. You know, it's like,
they try to make this sound plausible by, well, for one thing, there have been these sort of anti-blasphemous cartoon demonstrations going back to the Danish cartoon incident.
Yeah, right, right.
And so, and then here's where it gets interesting. You know, if you look at the pictures
that,
on
that was a step. Yeah,
yeah.
That was
the,
I, I think, the Danish thing.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, I think it's a setup with a narrative. The narrative is angry Muslims who hate our freedoms, hate cartoonists. And in fact, it's actually hate cartoonists and Jews, because not only in Paris did these guys first go after the free speech cartoonists and then go after a Jewish target, which was the kosher deli. But then in the follow-up incident, the mirror incident over in Copenhagen, it was exactly the same pattern. They went after the free speech anti-Islam cartoonists and shot up those people having a meeting. And then they went to the local synagogue where they supposedly shot up a wedding that was happening at something like 1 a.m. And so, you know, I mean, whoever is scripting these cartoons, it seems like they maybe need a new scriptwriter, because they often seem to repeat their plots like that.
Well, I think what it is, you know, there's a concept in literature called foreshadowing or prefiguration, you know. And so, like, if you watch a Hollywood movie, right? Let's say you're just watching one of these typical Hollywood movies, and early in the movie, you see some little kids playing on the train track, right? And they're playing nonchalantly on the train tracks, and you see the train is coming along. And at the very last moment, when it looks like maybe some little kid is going to get it, maybe his older brother snatches him away at the last moment, and he doesn't get, you know, hit by the train, right? Now, I say that happens early in the movie, right? Or, you know, early in the movie, there's some people, you know, mountain climbing, and somebody nearly falls off a cliff, you know, whatever. I mean, how much you want to bet that later in the movie somebody's going to, you know, get nailed by a train, right? And maybe the same place.
Well,
you know?
It was the playwright Strindberg, I believe. I think was it Strindberg who said that if you have a revolver hanging on the wall in the first act, it has to go off by the third act.
Right. That's called prefiguration, right? That's literature. These are the, you know, keys. So that these things get prefigured. Now the problem is, you sound crazy, because the Danish cartoon episode is 10 years before Charlie Hebdo. It's 2005, I believe.
Yeah, well, so I was talking about the terror attacks in Copenhagen that happened on Valentine's Day 1 month after Charlie Hebdo.
Yes. But I'm talking...
Yeah, when the whole thing started with the original Danish cartoon incident 10 years earlier, yeah.
Right, which I think is a psyop. But the thing about it is that it's not that they really had, you know, Charlie Hebdo planned 10 years in advance, and that they're playing three-dimensional chess so many moves in advance, sort of thing. It's that they've got the narrative possibilities sort of dangling around, floating around, that they can then use.
Yeah, you know, like with a TV series, you know, or a sitcom or something, where each episode, you know, they have the characters, they have the basic narrative thrust, and then they explore the different angles.
Well, there's running gags. Like, remember Get Smart? I mean, you'd have the Cone of Silence, you know. This is top secret, Chief. Shouldn't we be using the Cone of Silence? And, you know, it's just this running gag, you know, because they you know, Get Smart, right? I mean...
Yeah, I'm old enough to remember that.
Well, you're a bit older than I am, just a few years, but you know, the Cone of Silence, and, you know, and then the first thing, and, you know, the chief, who was the straight man, says, well, you know, chief, we really need to use the Cone of Silence, and okay, Larry, bring in, let's, you know, we're going to use the Cone of Silence, and then, you know, it's always these gags, you know, the first time maybe. It's such a good cone of silence that they can't hear one another, and then the next time there's, you know, there's a bee in there, and you know, I mean, you know, there's just all of these, but you know, they've got this narrative gag going on with the cone of silence. So the cartoons and just how pissed off Muslims get about cartoons.
Isn't that interesting? That's like having cartoons being the, you know, the freedom thing that the Muslims are fighting, whereas what you're saying is step back and frame the whole thing as a cartoon. I mean, it's basically a cartoon about hatred of cartoons.
yeah, that's true.
and speaking of cartoonish violence, how about that Tom and Jerry stuff with the fake beheading videos that you discuss in your first article? I mean, I thought that was one of the many strong points of your first article, was your discussion of those ludicrous ISIS videos.
Yeah, but almost every everybody I talk to was just assumes that these things are real. I mean, there's the bluff aspect that people won't watch them because they're afraid that they're going to see somebody actually getting beheaded, you know, and that's understandable. And finally, you think, well, gee, these things, there's something fake about this. And finally, when you watch them, it's just they're just comically fake, right?
Mm-hmm. And I thought, like, when the Daily Mail, the mainstream paper in the UK, did the article, you know, quoting these various experts explaining that these are fake, that was almost comical, too, because, you know, they're taking so seriously and using such careful science to prove something is fake that is so obviously fake. It's like having a bunch of scientists proving that, you know, the Tom and Jerry cartoons are not really a fight between a real cat and a real mouse.
Yeah. And that's an interesting thing because, you know, it's like this Architects and Engineers for 9/11 truth. You know, they're just there with this continual wonkish science about why a plane hitting a skyscraper of that size would not cause what we see. You know, I took a different approach. If you recall, I referred to it as the wings on pigs narrative, you know?
Yeah, that was great metaphor there.
The WAP narrative, you know?
And even if pigs did have wings, just, you know, bird wings on a pig wouldn't get it off the ground anyway. And that is pretty much how this all works, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you just can't imagine really that you could transplant, you know, you take the wings of an eagle, which are the most impressive wings in the animal world, and they're still, you know, you drop the pig with the wings off a cliff, it's just going straight down, you know. I mean, there's no, I mean, you don't need any heavy-duty science to know that.
I mean, of course, that's where Chomsky comes in and says, I'm a scientist, and I spent so much time doing science. I have so much respect for the knowledge of scientists. And if these people who say 9/11 was an inside job were serious, they would have published more than the 30 peer-reviewed papers they've already published. They would have published, now it's 300 peer-reviewed, I don't know. Like, where?
Well, but the funny thing about it is you don't need peer review. You know, I mean, he's saying, oh, yes, well, you know, he gave that video where he's talking at the University of Florida, you know.
That's the famous one.
And it's like, oh, well, you see, that's not what you do. You go to the learned societies, you submit articles to the publications. And you know, but the thing is that you submit articles to the publications when you really think you've discovered something new in physics or in chemistry or something. 9/11 truth, they're not nobody's really saying we discovered something new in physics or something new.
Except for NIST with its thermal expansion.
Right, but I mean I mean if somebody tells you a story that is a flying pig story. You know, you're not making some scientific discovery by saying the story's not true because actually pigs can't fly, you know.
Mm-hmm. That would be a good article for the Journal of Applied Engineering Mechanics. why yeah, pigs, you know, pigs don't have wings and even couldn't fly even if they did.
Yeah, I mean, you don't. I mean, if you're operating on refuting a wings on pigs narrative, you don't really need to go to the American Journal of blah blah blah. You know, I mean, it's, you know, the basic argument he's making is, of course, ludicrous. And of course, what's funny about it, it occurs to me, is it's utterly anti-democratic. You know, it's the idea that an ordinary person, just an ordinary education level, just cannot understand any basic thing, you know?
Yeah, that's right. And somebody like Chomsky, who's supposedly for people power, supporting this outlook,
yeah, he's supposedly a left anarchist and so forth. You know?
Well, you know, gentlemen, I think we're about at the end of the hour, and I have to chop this thing so it'll fit into the required slot. But there's a lot more we could talk about. You need to come back on the show sometime.
Oh, I would be glad to. I greatly enjoyed the conversation. Thanks for having me.
Likewise. I really enjoy your articles, and I'll be linking them at the radio blog truthjihadradio.blogspot.com, or you can get there by way of the main website truthjihad.com, which is once again working. Shout out to Eric Sayward, who finally got it working. All right, well, thank you again, Jonathan Robusky. Keep up the great work, and I do hope to have you back pretty soon.
Okay, thanks, Kevin.
Take care.
Chemical attacks. Okay, listen, poison. Deadly gases, bombs, the instruments of mass death, nuclear weapons, nuclear program, nuclear scientists, nuclear holy warriors.